This is Jim Inkster. Coming next on the show, we'll talk with Father Robert Sirico, Roman Catholic priest and founder of the Acton Institute for the Study of Religion and Liberty. He is a political and cultural commentator, and we'll talk with him about the Catholic Church on social issues in the new era of Pope Francis. Also, Bruce Allen Murphy, his book is Scalia, A Court of One. He writes about arguably the most dominant and controversial Supreme Court justice currently serving. And we'll talk with Bruce Allen Murphy, who previously wrote a book about Justice William Douglas. And Rachel Urquhart, she has received outstanding plaudits for her debut novel, The Visionist. All this today, but now the news on 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, please call 877-217-5757. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Our leadoff guest is the Reverend Robert Sirico. Father Sirico received his Master of Divinity degree from the Catholic University of America following undergraduate study at the University of Southern California and the University of London, and during his studies and early ministry, he experienced a concern over the lack of training in religious studies involving fundamental economic principles. And as a result, he founded the Acton Institute in Grand Rapids, Michigan. That's where Father Sirico is a parish priest at Sacred Heart Church, and he is here to talk about what is going on in the Catholic Church from a economic perspective and a social realm. Father Sirico has been a commentator for NPR, CNN, ABC, the BBC, and he's also had his work in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. Good morning, Father Robert Sirico.
Great to be with you, Jim. Thanks for having me.
Nice to talk with you. So how is the Catholic Church doing regarding poverty? Is the Church addressing it appropriately?
Well, I certainly it's an abiding concern, especially under this pope. I think some of the practical recommendations that have been made are insufficient. There's a preoccupation on the part of, and in this regard I wouldn't say just Catholics, but I think Christians in general, a preoccupation with redistribution in terms of helping the poor. Certainly charity and aid organizations are necessary, but I don't think they're sufficient. I think we need to look at the structural causes of poverty and look at the way in which people and nations have risen out of poverty. And the short answer to that is through access to work, through business. And I think we need to come to a deeper appreciation of how a market economy can help raise the poor out of poverty.
Well, why is the church the place to address this?
Well, the Church gives us a larger context in which human beings can flourish. A market economy by itself just tells us about the material needs and wants that people have. But believers can tell us about the destiny of the human person as such, you know, that God wills to be in union with people, about moral values, about limits on what people ought to be buying or selling or ingesting or investing in.
So you're a capitalist.
Well, I don't like the word capitalism because I think it's too narrow. Again, you know, it's a word affixed to the free economy by Marx and his disciples. Do I believe in a free economy? Yes. But I also believe that there's something more that's necessary. It's not just freedom, it's also virtue that's required for okay. real human flourishing.
All right, so you're not a socialist.
No, certainly not.
I didn't think so.
No.
Well, what about
been
the...
there, did that.
Yeah, you have evolved, as many yes. people do in their lives, and yes. you now take a different approach regarding the economy, and one right. that is more conventional as far as the way our country works. But in our country, the gap between the haves and have-nots has increased dramatically over the last quarter century, and some people are okay with that, but others say it's a dangerous prospect if it continues.
I hear that a lot. Certainly, certainly the market, if we look at not just the United States, though perennially here, or especially here, but throughout the world, we see in the last 100 years or so a rise of living standards in terms of access to drinkable water or food and shelter and the like. For me, the real question isn't the gap. I don't care much that Warren Buffett doesn't have quite as much money as Bill Gates. That's a gap, too. The real question is the floor. How do the poor stand? The people who are most vulnerable, are their lives appreciably better than their ancestors? And the answer to that question is an emphatic yes. Do we need to do more? Yes. Are there distortions of the economy and the world of labor and the world of employment and the like? Yes. There's lots more that needs to be done. But we know now how to produce wealth, how to sustain life. The very fact of growing population over these 50 years or so is an indication that the conditions for human well-being are much better than they were in previous generations.
297-5633 if you'd like to join the conversation in our remaining time with Father Robert Sirico, who heads the Acton Institute and has revealed, to no surprise, based on his recent writings and comments, that he is a free market priest. Now, do you believe that President Obama and the Congress of the United States went in the right direction with this Obamacare endeavor?
No, I think they went in exactly the wrong direction. And they settled there. You know, really what the president wanted was a more of a one-payer system. And they settled for manipulating the insurance companies into some kind of a scheme. But I think if people continue to not understand the price of the service that they get in the form of medicine, medical care, that we are not going to utilize the system efficiently. There's going to continue to be great waste in the system. You imagine going into a supermarket without prices, and you're just told, well, you could just choose what you need. The kinds of excesses that would occur in that circumstance. I've asked doctors, do you know what the cost of your medical care is for a given procedure? And they don't know very often. And it has to do with this third-party payer system and the amount of government involvement that already exists in our healthcare system. So to add more to it, I think, is a disaster.
There has been no better barometer of how the American people will vote in presidential elections than the votes of Roman Catholics who have voted for Ronald Reagan with a majority, with Bill Clinton with a majority. And recently with President Obama, although I think the gap is narrower with Catholics than it is with the American populace as a whole. But there obviously are people from all political stripes within the church. You're sounding like a conservative, and nothing wrong with that, but you have parishioners, I'm sure, who disagree with you. How do you square that?
Well, left and right, conservative and liberal, are political terms. And in point of fact, I'm not a member of a political party. When I prepare my homilies on the weekends, I'm not considering what the politically correct message is to preach. I'm considering what the theologically correct message is to preach. In the world of economics, in the world of, you know, social commentary, I just look at things and try to assess what is true and state it as best I can and hopefully as charitably as I can. I don't always succeed in that regard. But so in my own parish, which tends to be, I think, a more conservative parish, although it's working class and a lot of union members, I'm sure there are a lot of people who would support things that I don't support. I try to not corner people. I keep the message focused on the teachings of the church and the gospel. And then in other forms where people can have a free-ranging discussion, then we can deal with some of the more prudential or diverse points of view the Catholics are entitled to hold.
Here in Louisiana,
I'm in Michigan.
Well, I know. I'm in Louisiana.
You said here in Louisiana. I thought you said you.
I was about to refer to something in Louisiana.
Yes, yes.
I know exactly where you are, but we have a Democratic U.S. Senator, Mary Landrieu, who was threatened to be denied Holy Communion because she supports abortion rights. Is that something that priests should do?
Well, you know, it's not even a matter of an individual priest. The priest is guided by canon law. And there is an assessment on the part of the highest canonist in the country, in the world, Cardinal Burke, who says that this particular canon, I think it's 930, applies to Roman Catholics who deny fundamental Catholic teaching. Now, let's make a distinction between what abortion is and what, let's say, minimum wage laws or Obamacare is. Catholics can differ on these prudential applications of the Church's teaching. I don't say that Obamacare is wrong because of the doctrine of the Church. I say it's, other than the abortion provisions, I say it's wrong because it doesn't make economic sense. But with regard to the teaching on abortion, this is non-negotiable fundamental teaching of the Church that has been for 2,000 years. So the case is that given her public stance in defiance of the Church's teaching, that she has herself cut herself off from communion with the Church, and she should not receive Holy Communion. If she insists on doing it, then that's where a priest would decide, I can't give you Holy Communion. I would hope that would be dealt with privately and pastorally with every effort to, you know, persuade.
But we have a senator who, to my knowledge, has never had an abortion, does not encourage other people to have them, but just says, as a public servant, that it's none of my business if you want to have one. Why would she be denied communion?
She would be denied communion the same way Klansmen in Louisiana were denied communion for defiance of the Church's teaching on racial dignity. She would be denied communion the same way that Theodorus was denied communion by St. Ambrose for his murder, even though didn't murder, he facilitated the murder of thousands of...
Well, there you go. You got people who, Klansmen, who may have committed murder, certainly advocated violence against other people.
Right.
And you have another person who facilitated a murder. Somebody who is in favor of abortion rights is not, in most people's view, Father, encouraging people to have abortions, just saying that it's a fundamental right as a person in this society to do this if you wish to do it, and it's not the right of the government to step in the middle.
Well, not even from a position of religion, although in this case we're talking about a person who professes to hold to the truths of the Catholic faith, but from the position of a humanist, from a reasonable position, abortion is the taking of a human life. And to say that somebody would advocate the right of people to take the life of another person violates, I think, humanist ethical codes, and of course it violates the explicit teaching of the Church. No one forces the senator to be a member of the Catholic Church. That's her option. And if she wants to profess the teaching of the Church, you just say, then profess it. And if you don't, then you be the one to say, no, I will withdraw.
297-5633 is your number. We will go to the phone lines after a short break and return with Father Robert Sirico. If you're outside the area, please call 877-217-5757. Inkster Show at WRKF.org online. Father Robert Sirico of Grand Rapids, Michigan, where he heads the Acton Institute, which delves into social issues within the Church, particularly economic ones. And he is a free market minister. He at one time, Father Sirico, promoted left-wing politics, but he, as we can hear, has changed his points of view on a variety of fronts. And we will return with Father Robert Sirico in Grand Rapids by way of Brooklyn after this 90-second pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Frank Barnett is producing, and in just a moment, we'll hear from Bruce Allen Murphy. His book is Scalia, A Court of One. But we return to Robert Sirico. Father Sirico heads the Acton Institute in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and he is a man who is at the forefront of discussions on political and social issues. Is there anything about Pope Francis that's been a surprise as far as statements he has made? Father Sirico?
It's always a surprise with this Pope because he speaks, they say in Italian, a braccio, right from the cuff, right off the cuff. And so I think he has surprised anyone who's been an observer of the Vatican, and including those inside the Vatican. So, yes, the statements that very often need to be clarified at times because he's thinking right off the top of his head. His gestures, I think, are very powerful. The one that I think of is his embrace of the man with the distortions, the physical distortions, and really kissing the wounds of this man. So I think he is a pope that is very complex, much more complex than I think people appreciate. I think he's worth really paying attention to.
You mentioned, and I followed up with a discussion briefly about your evolution from a socialist to a free market person. How did that happen?
Well, you know, it was the 1970s. I was involved in the fervor of the anti-war movement, the farm workers movement. I was living in California at the time, the beginnings of the gay movement and the feminist movement. And one day, a friend of a friend of mine gave me some books to read, had a good argument with me, and we just continued that argument for about 6 months, and I began to read on actual economics, you know, not just kind of around the issue. I wasn't a serious Marxist in the sense of being an orthodox Marxist, though I had friends who were. And the more I read, the more I realized that the things I wanted to achieve in terms of the well-being of the poor, inclusivity, you know, productivity for human beings to be sustained, was better accomplished through free economic arrangements than government command and control. And so I just gradually left the left, and that basically reintroduced me. During this time, I wasn't a practicing Catholic. I had a reconversion to my faith and then went to seminary.
Well, we thank you for joining us today, Robert Sirico, and hopefully we'll have occasion to talk soon. You're an interesting
person. I'd enjoy that very
person.
Much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
297-5633 is your number, and we switch gears, and we're joined by Bruce Allen Murphy, who perhaps is the biggest chronicler of the United States Supreme Court. He's the Fred Morgan Kirby Professor of Civil Rights at Lafayette College in Easton, Pennsylvania, where he teaches constitutional law, civil rights and liberties, and as well as American politics and biographical writing. His latest work is Scalia, A Court of One, Antonin Scalia, the most controversial, outspoken Supreme Court justice of the past three decades, is his target. Good morning, Bruce.
Good morning, Jim.
Why is Justice Scalia a towering figure, like him or not, on the U.S. Supreme Court?
Well, I think he's a towering figure for a couple of reasons, stemming from his real intellect and his ability to argue legal issues. He came to the court with the expectation that he would unite the court. That's who Ronald Reagan thought he was getting. And once he got on the court, he took positions relative to his more senior justices that put him at odds with people more in the centrist position on the court, fracturing the court and causing the court to become a bit more polarized, much more polarized over time. And the other reason why I think he has become so visible is that when he came to the court in 1986, the court had for 16 years pretty much abstained from work off the bench, extrajudicial speeches, activities, joining groups, taking positions on issues outside of their official duties. And Scalia set about almost immediately changing that ethical standard and has become the most visible member off the court, giving nearly 250 speeches over the last 10 years and becoming the representation of a certain position on social issues on this court.
He is a conservative, has never made any inclination that he's not, but he had a somewhat controversial tenure before he became a Supreme Court Justice. How was his confirmation so streamlined as opposed to, say, Robert Bork?
You know, it's interesting because that's the view I held as well. I imagined that before Scalia came to the court, he would have been controversial. How could it be that he got a 98-0 vote in his favor in the confirmation? And when I looked at the descriptions in the press and in the legal publications about who they thought Scalia would be, universally, people thought he would become the William Brennan of the right.
Really?
William Brennan had united the Warren Court into a galvanized liberal force of activism in the 1960s. And everybody thought that Scalia would do the same for the conservatives. And the reason was that Scalia, in fact, before he came to the court, was extremely successful at every level. He was really two different people and had been that way since his college years. There was the actor who was very successful on the stage at Georgetown University, and he was known as Tony Scalia, very likable, very gregarious, very charismatic. And then there was the national championship debater who was maybe the best college debater of his day in the 1950s. He was known as Nino Scalia. And the tough-like college debaters are very aggressive, win at all costs, use ad hominem attack. And so when he came to the court and was presented to the Senate, I think everyone thought they were getting Tony Scalia. And there was nothing really controversial about him. He had been very successful as the Office of Legal Counsel for Gerald R. Ford. He had gotten rave reviews on the District of Columbia Court of U.S. Appeals and was able to work through some very tough issues. He was able to outmaneuver Robert Bork for that nomination. But when he arrived on the bench in that first set of conferences, he was a very different person. And once he was in oral arguments, he took over those oral arguments and became a very aggressive sort of debate-style justice.
Well, he was the valedictory speaker for his class at Georgetown, and he was editor of the Law Review at Harvard, so he's a brilliant man. No one has questioned his intellect, but in his years before becoming the Supreme Court Justice, he worked in the Nixon administration in the Office of Telecommunications Policy. He actually had an impact on public broadcasting, didn't he?
He did indeed, and he was very successful in opposing the White House. Richard Nixon and his advisors were trying to find a way to defund public broadcasting, and they were trying to find a way to do it without making it appear as though it was the partisan attack that it would have been. Scalia was in the Office of Telecommunications and was working as the counsel for that group, and was trying as best he could to keep the Nixon administration out of that issue and to make it possible for public broadcasting to be funded, but not to be funded on a national level, but rather in a station-by-station process. That's one side of Scalia. He was a very skillful political and legal operative in the Nixon administration and in the Ford administration. But you mentioned his work at Georgetown and his valedictory address. There's another side to Scalia. That valedictory address, which was called the Kohan-Guraten address, was actually a call to action for Catholics. He said to his classmates, "We are the chosen few, and if we will not lead the nation toward a Catholic vision, then who will?" And pretty much that's what he's done in his later year work on the Supreme Court. He has a very conservative, traditional, pre-Vatican II orientation, very different from Pope Francis, who you were speaking about with Father Sirico, and has taken a position more like earlier popes on questions such as the death penalty and other social issues.
Well, the Catholics are certainly overrepresented based on the national population on the U.S. Supreme Court.
It's an oddity now of the religious orientation of the court. For many, many decades, more than a century, it was unusual to even have a Catholic seat, and there was no Jewish seat on the court. It was almost exclusively a Protestant bastion. Now you have a court that is consists of six Catholics and three Jewish justices, and it is a court that has no Protestants on it at all. Some argue that this doesn't make a difference at all, that justices don't decide based on their religion. Others say that that in fact a justice decides based on who they are as a human being, and so religion has to be a part of that.
Justice Scalia, in the book from Bruce Allen Murphy, the subtitle is A Court of One. Has he had the capacity to influence other justices on big votes by the court?
Only a few times, and not always successfully. This is a team institution. It's less and less so as time goes on, but you can't do much unless you can put together five votes and have a majority on an issue. And Scalia, from the very first moment that he came to the court, took positions and wrote opinions in ways that alienated the moderate conservatives whose votes he needed in order to put together a majority. However, there have been some successes for him, and they've been very significant. He was able to keep Anthony Kennedy in favor of George Bush in the Bush v. Gore case, and was able to keep Anthony Kennedy again and Clarence Thomas on his side in the Heller versus District of Columbia case dealing with the Second Amendment gun rights back in 2008. So Scalia has the capacity to do that kind of lobbying and do that kind of care and feeding of his colleagues to keep them on his side. But he's much happier, I think, sort of voting and writing as a kind of independent lone wolf, taking his positions and not having to compromise in doing so.
But if he is the person most responsible for George Bush being named president, essentially by the U.S. Supreme Court, all the things that happened in the Bush administration were affected by that. He had a big impact on the world at large, didn't he?
Oh, he certainly did. And interestingly enough, he would have no problem going around the world giving speeches, going around the country giving speeches on those issues, went to Australia, criticized his liberal, living, evolving constitutionalist colleagues by calling them the mullahs of the West, and said in Puerto Rico that they had some idiotic ideas on evolving constitutionalism, and gained a lot of controversial notoriety in doing these kinds of things. Went down to Louisiana duck hunting with Vice President Cheney while Vice President Cheney was a named litigant in the case before the Supreme Court. But despite all of his decisions and work on behalf of causes that were acceptable to the Bush administration, when he really needed President Bush's support in 2005 to be named Chief Justice, he had become so controversial, so much of a lightning rod, that in fact the appointment went to Justice Roberts rather than Scalia.
Was he disappointed?
There are mixed reactions. He says that it was a job he didn't like, but behind the scenes people say that he wished he had at least been asked.
297-5633. We will go to the phone lines for Bruce Allen Murphy, who has written other books about Supreme Court justices, including William Douglas, and his latest work is Scalia, A Court of One. A question from Rick Causey about lifetime appointments. Will that ever change? Will the Supreme Court always have lifetime security for those who are on the court?
It's a very good question. Now, we are in the middle, I think, of of a rolling critique of the court, not unlike the court packing fight of 1937. There have been in the last decade several proposals for limiting judicial tenure, and they come out of a notice that the court has, for decades, replaced itself, maybe one justice every 2 years. But in the last 20 or 25 years, that number has expanded to 4 years, and we now see a court that continues to age and is one of the oldest courts in history. I think that the likelihood of that changing, though, is less probable, because you would have to change the Constitution by an amendment, and getting the Congress or the states to agree on any issue which would have such a polarizing effect in a kind of dysfunctional political kind of environment would be very difficult.
Rose in Sherwood. Good morning, Rose. You're on the air with yours truly and Bruce Allen Murphy. We need to get Bruce back.
Yes. Good morning. I just have a quick comment and then a quick question. I'm a Vatican II baby myself, and I totally endorse Vatican II, as did Pope John Paul II. In fact, you commented on Iraq. If you remember correctly, sir, our John Paul was against going to war. So I'm surprised that Scalia did not follow that, since he is a support, as you allege, a supporter of.
Okay, let's see if we can get Bruce Allen back. Thank you, Rose. Appreciate your comments. 297-5633, and we've at least for a moment lost contact with Bruce Allen Murphy. His book is about Antonin Scalia, who at the age of 50 was appointed to the U.S. Supreme Court in a 98-0 vote by the United States Senate, including John Breaux and Bennett Johnston. Actually, that was Russell Long and Bennett Johnston in 1986 when Ronald Reagan was president. Rose in Sherwood asks about the church largely being a pacifist in times of war, saying war is a last resort, and Justice Scalia has been supportive of presidents who advocated military intervention. Is there a disconnect in any way with that?
Well, that's a very interesting question, because I think your caller would also mention that for years the church has been pro-death penalty, but in the last 15 years or so, the church has been moving away from the death penalty and the kind of sanctity of life. I think Scalia's answer on these questions, and he is very pro-presidential power and very pro-military and has been that way in the terrorism cases, his answer is that he takes his instruction from earlier popes and the earlier church, and doesn't follow the modern teaching. He really is very much a pre-Vatican II, before the 1960 reforms, Catholic traditional.
297-5633, 877-217-5757, your numbers for Bruce Allen Murphy. We'll return with him. His book is Scalia, A Court of One. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. A few more minutes with Bruce Allen Murphy. Scalia, A Court of One. As I mentioned, he's written other books about Supreme Court justices, including William Douglas and Abe Fortas. Scalia, how does he compare with those giants on the court who preceded him?
Well, he's every bit as brilliant as William O. Douglas, who I thought was the most brilliant member of the court at his time. And he is also similar to Douglas in that he very much likes the limelight. He is, I think, still an academic at heart. He likes being in front of a live audience. It's always a wonderful show if anybody has the opportunity to go listen to him. He always has very controversial comments, takes questions from all of his audience, and doesn't back down on any issues. And I think, too, that like Douglas, Scalia has very certain views. He believes he's correct about these questions and is not willing to compromise with his colleagues. He'll take a loss if it means he can get his position out there.
John in New Roads asks, what's your view Bruce on the relationship currently between Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Scalia?
It seems we're reading tea leaves. When you're doing court analysis, everything inside the court is confidential, and the clerks and all of the people who work there sign confidentiality agreements. So you're sort of reading tea leaves in the way that opinions are written and little bits and pieces that come out in the press. It seems like Scalia wishes that the chief would be more consistent in the kind of conservatism that Scalia favors. But the difficulty for any chief justice is you have to be the chief justice of the entire court for the United States. And so if you are given the decision on the Affordable Care Act, the Obamacare decision, you have to make sure that you put the court in a position that it's not going to become a political football in an election year, 2012. And so Roberts had to kind of split the middle, agreeing with the conservatives on the question of the Interstate Commerce Act, but then agreeing with the liberals that perhaps the taxation power would allow for the Congress and the president to have the Affordable Care Act enforced. I think that disappointed Scalia, but I very much understand the difficulty that the Chief Justice had in making that decision.
Well, you noted that he is a devout Catholic. He has 9 children, right?
He does indeed. And he was the only child of his generation in his extended family. So this is quite a change for the Scalia family. A very accomplished family, very accomplished set of children. Scalia's views on Catholicism are pretty evident in his social issue decisions and the abortion issue and the gay rights question, the death penalty. He's trying to turn the clock back to an earlier era of understanding of these questions and not getting a lot of support from some of the members of the court for that position.
Does he have contempt for the justices who are also Roman Catholic who do not share his views on these issues?
I don't think so, but remember, this is a fellow who's a professional, who is accustomed to the give and take of argumentation. I don't think you can function in a small group institution like the court and have contempt or even dislike for any other member of the court. The question is, can you get to a position that you can negotiate with people who have opposite views from yours and try to move them to your position? And Scalia's behavior in all issues as a member of his court of one is that he would rather not do that. He would rather state his position and not compromise his views terribly much in order to get a majority vote.
A few inquiries from listeners. Don wants to know what Justice Scalia did to persuade Justice Kennedy to vote to install George Bush as president in 2000.
I think what he was trying to do was persuade Kennedy that the sanctity of the presidential vote would have been diminished if they tried to look at the review of the votes county by county using different methods. That was what was going on in Florida. He was arguing that each county had a different way of counting the hanging chads or the dangling chads of the voting ballot. And he was arguing that that's a violation of the Equal Protection Clause, that you should use one method or no method at all and just ratify the vote that had already been offered. The interesting thing, though, is in making that argument, Scalia, a states' rights advocate, was arguing that you should not listen to Florida's Supreme Court. And Scalia and the conservatives, who did not argue that equal protection of the 14th Amendment should govern voting, was now for this one case saying that they should do that. And in that opinion, the court added one line saying, don't be using this decision as a precedent down the road. It's for this case only. So it was a very unusual case. And it shows you what Scalia could have done if he'd used that soft touch with those moderate conservatives. He could have been more successful in writing some of his views into law.
In that case, it's quite possible that the five justices who voted for Bush on the court also voted for him on Election Day, and the four who voted for Gore voted for Gore on Election Day. Even the Supreme Court, Bruce Allen Murphy, even these justices who are supposedly immune from public opinion and their own personal opinions, sometimes it's hard to believe that they're not in play.
It's true. There are some justices who didn't vote, John Harlan, Hugo Black, some justices who their political designation had no influence on what they did on the court. But this court, since that time, since Bush v. Gore, has largely been, actually more particularly, since the retirement of John Paul Stevens and David Souter. So we're talking 2010. It has largely been five Republicans voting against four Democrats, and that is unprecedented. This is a very polarized court now, very much the mirror of our political structure, very polarized, very partisan, and in voting this way, they put themselves in position to be attacked by political forces.
Lastly, Gina asks, has Justice Scalia ever been persuaded to vote in a different way than he originally was intending to by one of his colleagues?
Well, he has taken some interesting positions that are not consistent with what you would expect the conservatives to view. He did vote in favor of flag burning in 1989. He has consistently voted in favor of face-to-face questioning in court, the confrontation clause of the Sixth Amendment, and thus protecting defendants who were pretty clearly guilty of the crimes and trying to protect the young witnesses from having to testify against them. And then the major issue that I think he's been very interesting in his votes on the question of search and seizure using technological means, GPS tracking of cars or thermal imaging cameras or even of looking into houses to see if marijuana was being grown, or the taking of DNA samples by cheek swab for people who had been arrested in Maryland, Scalia has argued that the framers would never have accepted those kinds of searches and seizures. And so, unlike many conservatives, he's been voting in favor of defendants' rights in doing that. But the specific question of changing his mind because of the persuasion of other justices, and so he adopts a position different from what he holds off the court, that's not a very common occurrence for Antonin Scalia.
Well, thank you for joining us. Bruce Allen Murphy, the book from Simon & Schuster, Scalia, A Court of One. Good to talk with you, sir.
Good to talk with you, Jim. Thanks for the invitation.
My pleasure. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
297-5633, your number, Inkster Show, WRKF.org. And we switch gears and we're joined by Rachel Urquhart, and she is the author of The Visionist. It's her debut novel. She, of course, has written prolifically prior to this, and this book has received remarkable praise. Exquisite is how NPR terms it. Transfixing from the New York Times. Set in a Massachusetts farming community in the mid-19th century, the novel introduces a teenager, Polly, visited nightly by her abusive father, and unwilling to bear this brutality, she persuades her mother, May, and her little brother to flee the family farm, and in her rush to escape, Polly accidentally sets fire to their home, possibly killing her father. And May seeks shelter for the children in a Shaker community, the City of Hope. That's how it develops, and it is quite a story from Rachel Urquhart. Good morning, Rachel.
Good morning, Jim.
And it is based on truth, I hear.
Yes. I mean, I did about 3 years of research before I actually started writing in earnest. So I tried to be as, you know, follow the facts as closely as I could, especially with regard to specifics about the Shakers.
Well, the book is compelling from a perspective of the family, but also of this community, the Shakers, and this City of Hope. How did the family blend in?
You mean the family, Polly's family, who
Correct.
Arrived there? Yes. Well, basically, Polly and her brother are sort of abandoned in the community by their mother simply because she knows they'll be safe there. And the main part of the story is really that Polly, who has kind of suffered from these hallucinations as a result of the trauma that she's gone through all of her life because of her abusive father, she has a hallucination within the community once she's there, and the Shakers mistake her for something they called a visionist. And visionists were teenage girls, a select group of them, who the Shakers really thought had access to the divine world and had messages to bring them from that world.
The book is entitled The Visionist from Rachel Urquhart. And she is visited by her father, haunted by his abuse. The memory of him is certainly part of this. What happens when this occurs?
Well, whenever she thinks of her father, she slips into one of these sort of hallucinatory, trance-like states. And so, you know, the memory of him certainly, you know, triggers these things, but so do certain things that she experiences within the community that just sort of remind her of her life at home. They could have been they were as innocent as just the sound of the dancing and the noise and the commotion in the ecstatic worship rituals that the Shakers engaged in. So they weren't necessarily bad things that would trigger these episodes, but they were triggered in the community, and that's what sort of created this visionist-like behavior.
Rachel, you say before you started researching and writing The Visionist, you knew three things about the Shakers. What were the three things you thought you knew about them?
Well, I knew that they didn't have sex, which I think is the main thing that people know about the Shakers. I think the second thing that people know about the Shakers is that they made really beautiful furniture. And then the third thing I knew was that they shook, but I had absolutely no idea what shaking was. So I knew very little about them.
But in this three-year odyssey, in which you probably learned a lot about yourself, you learned a great deal about how the Shakers live, dance, dine, garden, heal, and worship.
I absolutely did. In particular, during the period that I was studying, which was a period that lasted from about 1837 until more or less 1850. And it was a religious revival that later became known as the Era of Manifestations. And it was a period that was largely characterized by the presence of these teenage visionists who I mentioned earlier. So I found that fascinating and extremely rich material for a novel.
Mm-hmm. Well, Polly is a captivating figure, and I think many people can relate to her dilemma based on this tragic past. Without giving away the novel in its totality, how do things evolve for her through the course of her past experience and her experiences with the Shakers?
Well, with Polly, I think I was really exploring the whole idea of the sort of imposter syndrome, which is, as in the most simplistic terms, is when, you know, people think you're one thing and you think you're another. And so I think she really struggles with this idea that she's been put up on a pedestal and actually turned into a very powerful figure in this new community. And yet she thinks of herself as a deeply troubled, deeply kind of sinful figure. More because of what's happened to her than because of her own behavior, and yet she feels sort of sullied by the abuse she's suffered. So it's about the kind of schism between those two things, perception and then how she perceives herself.
There are a few lessons, but what would be the major lesson that prevails in The Visionist?
I think one of the main themes that it explores is the sort of the strength of the individual versus the strength of the community. And in this case, not only is the individual, Polly Kimball, but there's another character who's very important in the book named Sister Charity, who is a lifelong Shaker, who is Polly's age and becomes very close to Polly. I think that they both struggle with, in their own ways, with individuality and how difficult it is in a rigid community like the Shakers.
The book is The Visionist, a novel from Rachel Urquhart, her debut novel. Her last name, by the way, is spelled Urquhart. Remember the name, and the book has received remarkable praise. And we thank you for sharing your story and that of the Shakers and of Polly today on our show. Thank you, Rachel.
Well, thanks so much for having me on the show, Jim.
Take care.
You too.
We'll be back tomorrow. Until then, stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.